dado a conocer que se extiende durante una semana más el Parlamento Abierto que iniciaron a principios de este mes para discutir y que distintos sectores fueran a la Cámara de Diputados a expresar sus puntos de vista en cuanto se refiere a la iniciativa que envió el presidente Andrés Manuel López Obrador para reformar la ley en materia de electricidad. Esto ocurrió el 1 de octubre y desde entonces lo que ha venido es una defensa por parte del gobierno, pero también enfrenta todos los argumentos que desde los puntos de vista de la oposición dicen estaría afectando esa reforma a México y también a sus inversiones. Sin embargo, por el otro lado, el presidente señala que de lo que se trata es de lograr tarifas justas y que además también quede en manos del Estado mexicano un sector muy importante, no solamente para la economía nacional, sino también en temas de seguridad. En esa situación se encuentra ahora mismo esta reforma en materia eléctrica que ha merecido que en menos de 30 días dos funcionarios de alto nivel de Estados Unidos vengan a México para que se discuta y también conversar con el presidente Andrés Manuel López Obrador sobre este tema en particular. Estamos hablando de la visita primero de la secretaria de Energía de Estados Unidos, Jen Granholm, quien vino a México con ese objetivo, y el día de ayer que estuvo aquí en territorio mexicano, John Kerry, el enviado para los temas del clima de la Casa Blanca, quien el día de ayer declaraba que esperaban que México lograra una reforma eléctrica con un mercado abierto y competitivo. Sin embargo, su mayor preocupación se centra en las inversiones que tienen empresas estadounidenses en territorio mexicano y también porque hay una cláusula muy relevante que está en discusión y que tiene que ver con el artículo 28 de la Constitución y que se refiere a que el litio, la industria del litio, quedará en manos del Estado mexicano y no podrá explotarse por parte de empresas privadas. El presidente López Obrador señaló que no habrá concesiones para empresas internacionales que quieran venir a operar en el tema del litio. Esa es una de las mayores preocupaciones porque no podemos dejar de lado que para 2030 Estados Unidos se ha propuesto que el 50% de los vehículos que circulen por sus calles sean eléctricos. ¿Esto qué necesita? Pues necesita un mineral como el litio para poder desarrollar las baterías y toda la situación que se requiere para poder echar a andar esos vehículos. Cabe destacar también que en el sector eléctrico, ahora mismo dominado por empresas españolas, está también el tema que el día de ayer el presidente puso en la palestra pública y que tiene que ver con las relaciones que existen entre México y España, que ahora mismo no atraviesan por su mejor momento. Y es que el presidente López Obrador el día de ayer hacía un llamado a poner una pausa en las relaciones bilaterales.
Lo que dije ayer es vamos por el bien de nuestros pueblos a tener una pausa. No hablé de ruptura, no. Dije, vamos a serenar la relación, que ya no se está pensando de que se va a saquear a México impunemente. Ya eso pasó, es una falta de respeto, deberían de ofrecer hasta disculpa. No lo han hecho, no importa. Pero vamos a entrar a una etapa nueva, despacio, y repito, no es ruptura.
Esto fue interpretado de muchísimas formas y el día de hoy el presidente López Obrador en su conferencia matutina lo aclaraba y señalaba que hablar de una pausa no es hablar de ruptura. Sin embargo, ha señalado que sí, las empresas españolas, las grandes empresas, han venido a México a tener privilegios y también a cometer abusos en contra de la población en contubernio con los gobiernos de corte neoliberal que le precedieron. Esto, dijo el presidente, no puede seguir así, y es ahí donde ha dicho el mandatario que se debe poner una pausa y bajar de tono las relaciones entre México y España. En el caso del sector eléctrico, puedo decirte que las empresas españolas tienen una importante participación en el mercado eléctrico, y además la reforma energética en materia de electricidad también señala que el mercado de generación eléctrica tendrá que quedar 56% en manos de la estatal Comisión Federal de Electricidad y el 44% restante en manos de las empresas privadas. Esto, por supuesto, no ha gustado a los grandes conglomerados de energéticos del mundo y por eso es que también hay muchísimos señalamientos en contra de esa iniciativa que el presidente pretende que se apruebe en esta misma legislatura que culminará en el mes de septiembre. Así la situación en torno a esta reforma en materia de electricidad, y por supuesto todavía queda un camino bastante largo por seguir en este tema, porque porque ahora está el Parlamento abierto, pero también viene la discusión en las comisiones de la Cámara de Diputados, después viene en el Pleno de este Congreso mexicano y después también tendrá que ser llevado al Senado. Una vez que sea aprobado por el Senado, regresa a la Cámara de Origen y tiene que ir a los congresos estatales porque se trata de una reforma de tipo constitucional y eso requiere que por lo menos 17 de los 32 congresos estatales aprueben esa iniciativa y con ello ya pueda ser promulgada por el presidente Andrés Manuel López Obrador y por supuesto pues ya tendrán los cambios en la constitución, pero hasta este momento en ese es donde va esta reforma en materia de electricidad, muy importante por los intereses que toca precisamente en cuanto a las empresas transnacionales que operan en territorio mexicano.
Estimado radio oyente, un pueblo bien informado está mejor preparado para defender sus derechos. Y esta emisora de radio transmite desde 1950.
And welcome to the November 17th edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. That's my show. I'm Robert Norris, and it's a net show that concerns itself with civil liberties for folks outside or the lack of those civil liberties. Today we're going to be looking at... we'll be listening to Helga, who's a Felton activist, very passionate, very particular, and very determined. And she's got, well, she's got a lot more feeling than I usually have regarding homeless issues. I kind of take a somewhat more austere view or distance view than she does. So it's a good counterpoint, or, yeah, it's a good sort of complement to the way I usually talk about stuff. I guess I have my hot buttons as well. In any case, and also you're going to be hearing, I suspect, lots of the HUF meeting that we had earlier today. That's the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting, which happens every week, though it won't be happening next week because it'll be Thanksgiving, and we're going to be tabling at the Vets Hall where they've restored a meal, you know, the once a year, maybe twice a year, really tasty meal. Of course, they don't have winter shelter, so nobody gets to go indoors who walks in and needs it, or walks up and needs it. But that's the way it is in Santa Cruz, and the way it was last winter as well. You got to be in a program, and even then, those serve less than a third of the people in the city who are outside. I suppose that's a big improvement from years ago, and it was just a handful of people. But to criminalize everyone and drive them out of their makeshift shelters, which is what happened throughout the last month in the Benchlands, under the claim, and the lying claim, that you have shelter for everyone is a disgrace. It's a form of stupidity because you're flooding people onto the streets and also creating fire dangers and destroying community contact points for those folks. It's not a good thing to do. But we rant on about it at the HUF meeting, and you can hear some of our ranting soon.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So, day before yesterday, last Tuesday, was the shitty council meeting, the Santa Cruz shitty council, which is how I tend to regard them. They call themselves the city council. The Part of the meeting that I usually look to first is the city mangler's report, or as he calls himself, the city manager. He's the most powerful individual in the city, probably gets paid the highest salary. I think he does. Used to be the case. I think it still is. That's Matt Huffaker, just in from Watsonville, or about, actually, he's been here now half a year, a little bit more, actually almost a whole year. And he's the one who demolished the benchlands with his plan of squeezing them like a vice without actually providing the adequate shelter, but claiming that his lieutenant or his hired hand, it's really his lieutenant, Jeremy Leonard, was actually offering people shelter. But in fact, numerous people who lived there told me they'd never been approached by Jeremy. So I'm not sure what I kind of know what to believe, because I don't think these people are necessarily going to lie to me. They seem pretty straightforward, doe in the headlights. Whereas Jeremy had a position to maintain, and he also expressed a lot of apprehension about the contacts with people in the benchlands, or at least some of them. He's concerned about gangs and being killed and having to come in with an escort and so forth. I thought it was an unfortunate position for a person who had taken that job. There are those, Brent Adams, for one, who heard the interview at the last, I guess it was at the Sunday show, who said that Jeremy had taken the position for money, but of course, most people do take a position to pay the rent. So, I mean, one can't blame someone for that. But the problem, of course, is when you take a position that involves destroying people's shelter, you've got to be held accountable for it, even if you're not the person making the decision. If you're the person effectuating that decision, then you've made a choice to be part of that machine. And, Jeremy, you made that choice. So, much as you may be a good kind of guy in many other ways, and that choice tends to brand you. And it leaves you scarred, not so scarred as the people whose lodgings you've destroyed, although you take some credit in helping a smaller number of people who went into this bogus shelter that doesn't really lead to housing for most of them. It leads back onto the street, and minus all the possessions that they had when they were in the benchlands. So it's bullshit, really. Anyway, Matt Huffaker is the guy I was really talking about. He's the man who is at the city council making a report, or at least continuing the city's narrative that everything is okay, I did a great job, it was a tremendous difficulty, but well, we pulled through. You get to hear him talking about his benchlands demolition, and why don't I let him sound off.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mayor and Council. Erica Smart, our communications manager, is going to pull up the slide deck for me. I've got a handful of updates for the Council and community this afternoon, so let's go ahead and jump in. Next slide, please. So as the Council knows, for the last several months, we have had staff from multiple departments working on a phased closure of San Lorenzo Park. The closure of the park was officially completed on November 7th, and it's really hard to overstate how complex and challenging this process was, and I wanted to take the opportunity to thank, this is a big number, our nearly 60 staff members that were part of the closure, as well as outreach to the individuals that were in the camp throughout.
So notice the sanitized language. Closure, not demolition, not destruction, not bulldozing of people's homes and shelters and tents and possessions, but closure, right? This is sort of a nice neutral sanitary term. And he also talked about the closure of San Lorenzo Park, not of an encampment, a survival encampment for several hundred people, leaving the majority of them without places to go, other than a phony sort of cycling system that would put some people in while forcing other people to leave to make room based on the fact that they can't legally force people out of an encampment under the Martin versus Boise decision unless they have an indoor shelter for them to take up residence in, at least for a certain period of time. It's not really too clear how long that period of time has to be. But it has to be indoors. It has to be... also has to be an opportunity for them to take their possessions with them. And none of these conditions were met. And in fact, many of the people, as I mentioned before, were not even given that particular option. And the people who wanted to use that option on the day couldn't use it because Jeremy Leonard wasn't there at that time. At least that's what they told me. Like that was the final day, either Phase 7 or Phase 8 of the closure at the end of October. So it was a pretty nasty, phony deal. And it's too bad the activists, like myself and others, didn't really do the kind of organizing and recruit the kind of legal assistance or even work on the kind of pro se, self-moving legal challenges that needed to be made in order to stop this as it had been stopped 2 years ago. It's true we're still trying to mobilize forces to stop the next encampment sweeps, as they're likely to happen, because people will camp because they need to survive, and they need to also be in groups for safety and for community and for all kinds of other reasons, for point of contact with the broader community. And so there'll be encampment closures coming up as well at those times. And perhaps the contacts that we have made in this round of destruction of campsites can be helpful in the next one. I don't think that's necessarily true at all, but it might be true. It might be helpful. Well, back to Mendacious Matt, as I might want to call him, the city mangler. And here's more of what his report to the city was on November 15th.
Of the last several months, and that contributed to the success of this closure and restoration process. And by extension, I want to also thank the council for your support and leadership throughout that process. Next slide.
And, of course, this is the usual really kind of distasteful backslapping that goes on among these... you know, I really should call them criminals, because that's kind of what they are. They are paid thugs in business suits who are destroying the survival gear, giving the orders to others to destroy the survival gear and the peace and the minor limited peace that some folks found in the benchlands, offering them inadequate resources instead, and then just proceeding to lie to the community about this whole situation, hence the word mendacious.
Now, I want to also point out and note that this was more than a closure and a restoration process. Our outreach also connected over 170 people with a higher standard of shelter, and everyone in the park was given the opportunity to move to an alternative shelter location.
This is, as I said before, not the testimony of numerous people who I spoke to in the course of the demolition, you know, the closure, the successful closure of the benchlands. So that's why I call it a lie, because even though he may have simply said, well, that's what my lieutenants Jeremy Leonard and Chris Monteith told me, it doesn't matter. His responsibility is to find out if it's true. And I don't think he really cared if it was true. I kept questioning him about where the beds were going to go and how much was going to be available. He kept ducking questions when I talked to him in the Civic Auditorium about 6 months ago. And he gave us some twisted language about how it's okay to demolish and all the other campsites throughout Santa Cruz and shovel everybody into the benchlands. This is not from his statements, but rather from the actions of the police, for which he is responsible. He is the city manager. He controls, hires, and fires the police chief. And he is also the one who hired and fired the homeless czar, Larry and Wally. I don't have his proper title, but that, in essence, is what his position is. So he's accountable for this stuff.
Also, for the first time, in partnership with the county, we were able to enter the majority of the individuals in the camp into the Homelessness Management Information System, also known as HMIS.
In other words, he could get everybody's name into a system so that, so they can be tracked, so they can get bigger grants for them and then not spend them on accommodations but use them instead to increase enforcement activity against people who don't fit into their square pegs into round holes situation. That seems to be what's going on here, or at least that's what I fear is going on here.
This may sound like a small feat, but in fact has been a challenge in past camp closures. And what this information does, it allows our outreach team to really provide a higher standard of case management services to better meet the individual needs of folks that are living unhoused in our community in ways that we've not been able to do in the past, and really in close partnership with our county partners in ways that, again, we've not experienced in the past. So.
And this is a form of a kind of really tacking on one mythology on another. It's the old idea that it's not the city's responsibility, it's the county. So county and the city have to get together, and they can sort of keep shifting responsibility and blame back and forth, while folks who are outside keep getting arrested, having their property destroyed, being forced to move while disabled, many of them, from one miserable encampment to another, while at the same time being told that they were being given great opportunities and real opportunities for housing, and this had never been done before. In fact, huge amounts of money were lavished on the city. I think the latest was $14.5 million to Robert Rettner, the big boy at the county in charge of these homeless boondoggles, you might say. So we must hear more.
I just wanted to acknowledge that it's really taken a village getting to the point that we are, and I'm incredibly proud of the work the team's done to connect those 170 individuals to a higher standard of shelter and on their way to permanent housing.
He is trying to be a little cautious here. He doesn't say they're going into permanent housing, or they're being guaranteed permanent housing, or there even is a high probability of they're getting permanent housing, though he implies it. That's always the way that Susie O'Hara used to move forward with these lavish descriptions of the wonderful kinds of activities that were claiming facilities that were available for folks outside. But what she was really doing was playing safeguard against individuals like Drew Glover and Chris Krohn and then Sandy Brown and every so often Justin Cummings, who were trying to establish real campgrounds or real indoor facilities, at least temporary encampments where people could subsist in a more humane, decent way and at least not be harassed if they chose to do something else, respected under the Martin versus Boise and essentially the Bill of Rights, the Constitution of the United States, a basic sense of the UN Charter, the human basic human rights that you don't have any trouble pinpointing a violation of human rights when you see it happen to poor people abroad. But when it happens, you know, in San Lorenzo Park, oh, it's those tramps, those bums, those drug dealers, those junkies. So it's considerably different when it happens nearby, and the politicians know and use this.
Of course, this process doesn't end with the closure and restoration of the park itself. The city team will continue to conduct regular assessments and outreach to people living.
A lot of assessing and outreaching, but not much in the way of services. And nothing in the way of winter shelter or walk-in winter shelter, anyway, for the majority of homeless people in Santa Cruz. The big missing factor this winter, last winter, might have been even the winter before. My memory is failing me at the moment on that.
Unhoused in other areas, we continue to partner with the county and community partners in this work, and that includes Healing the Streets, Front Street, Housing Matters, and the downtown outreach workers. Next month, the council...
all of whom provide no walk-in shelter for anybody. They don't even provide meals for people. It's Food Not Bombs that provides meals every day, noon to 3, at the town clock, in case you haven't been around or noticed. I ran into somebody today who said they hadn't noticed that. They didn't know it was happening. But most people have. And it's the city is footing none of the expenses, nor for that matter, as you've heard from Brent Adams in his lengthy interview on Sunday, laundry, showers, storage. None of this is being done by the city anymore. And it hasn't been done for years. It was never really done to any great extent. But the slack that was taken up by Brent Adams is now closed on November 15th. He will still be operating, if his account is accurate, the warming center on a handful of nights this winter. But it's not happening generally for people who need to go to a place, because a place during a cold or wet weather, because the city and the county are too damn cheap, not cheap towards consultants or developers, but too damn cheap to provide for the neediest folks of the most elementary kind of resources in winter. And that's one of the things that came up at the Huff meeting today. Briefly, we ranted about that as we rant about a lot of other things.
So we'll be receiving a quarterly homelessness response update from Larry M. Wally, our homelessness response manager, with more details as to what's to come as we move through this closure and restoration process.
The process, a closure and a restoration. See, they're going to restore it as a walking dog park, a grassy area that can be used for leisure by folks who are in more comfortable circumstances. That's very nice. Without any kind of provision being made for the significant number of people that are being dumped, whose property was destroyed, who were forced essentially onto the road throughout October, and which finally culminated in November. Let's have a musical break. The song is called Let Me Sing You a Song. It's a tribute to Pete Seeger by Joe Jenks, who wrote it and performed it. He was inspired, according to this description, by Pete Seeger's testimony in August 1955 before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. It was a get those commies and leftist group. A bunch of mostly reactionary senators in Washington.
You've asked me here to tell you about my neighbors and my friends. Talk about the who and what, the where and how and when. But I won't give you anything you don't already know. But if you'd like, I'll sing that list of songs before I go. Let me sing you a song about the people that I love, the poets and philosophers, the workers and the wanderers, the ones who walk the picket lines, who dare to stand and fight, and the ones who hold their babies close and rock them through the night. Now you say it's un-American to do the things I do. Well, I sing for justice, liberty, and civil rights, it's true. But I say it's un-American to ask me how I vote, how I pray or what I believe. Here's a song I wrote. Let me sing you a song about the people.
people that I love, the poets and philosophers, the workers and the wanderers, the ones who walk the picket lines, who dare stand and fight, and the ones who hold their babies close, rock them through the night. To send me to prison, I guess that's the way it'll be. 'Cause I won't give you fodder for your paranoid machine. If the price of my silence is shackles, well then, fellas, take me away. For I will live to sing again, rise with a brand new day. Let me sing you a song about the people that I know, the poets and philosophers, the workers and the wanderers, the ones who walk the picket lines, who dare to stand and fight, and the ones who hold their babies close, rock them through the night. Let me sing you a song about the people that I know, poets and philosophers, the workers and the wanderers, the ones who walk the picket lines, who dare to stand and fight, and the ones who hold their babies close, rock them through the night. Yes, the ones who hold their babies close, rock them through the night.
So next up is an interview with a relatively recently acquired or a person who just recently came to Huff meetings. It's Helga, who lives in Felton and has been living here for quite a while, according to the account she gives, well, in the interview you're about to hear. Why don't we let her describe her own situation and you get to listen. Today is the 14th of November. I'm on the line with Helga, who is a longtime Felton resident who has been particularly concerned with the services and the safety of homeless folks in Felton. Is that accurate there, Helga?
Yes.
How long have you lived here?
I lived in Felton now for about 35 years.
And how long have you been involved with folks outside?
For 35 years, because when I first moved there within a week, there was an old couple that was homeless, and I brought them blankets. That was my first service.
And on an average, let me ask you this. Has your contact with homeless people increased or decreased over this period of time?
I think the contact was a little bit better before all the people were taken out of the park, the parking fountain right by the river. They were systematically taken out by sheriffs for all the different reasons. They totally cleaned out. There used to be a lot more homeless people. I don't know where they are. Some of them died. Some of them went to Boulder Creek. Some of them went to Kent City. But I have steady connection and information from the homeless, I would say practically every day, because of those people that go around and find the homeless people for me. So I have, at least four or five times a week, I connect with people that are homeless.
So when did this clearing out of, are you talking about the covered wagon park, or are you talking about...
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay.
There used to be a
You there, Helga?
And then they took him out.
Do you remember?
A year or two, maybe. So this is now. No homeless people in that part.
How long ago did that happen?
I would say maybe two to three years.
And so was that a place where you regularly went to meet folks?
Yes.
And
they all know me. Everybody, all the homeless people in shop know my name.
And what do they know you as?
I'm sorry?
What do they call you?
Helga.
Of course, that's your name.
Some people actually call me Angel.
I see.
Believe it or not. Some of the homeless people, they say, oh, I know who you are. You are the one. Your name is Angel. That's my nickname.
I see. So in the older days, let's say 10, 20, 30 years ago, was that also a meeting place, or were there other places you would go
to
meet them?
No. There was no meeting place. They were very isolated people. You know, that wasn't a problem then. But there was an older couple that, you know the right church, right, Robert, in Shelton?
I do not. Tell me where that is.
It's right in the corner of, on the intersection of where the Mexican restaurant is and going up to Bonnie Doon. There's a white church with a white tower. When you drive over Graham Hill, you can see it. Or you drive over, yeah.
I do know what you're talking about. Yes, I think I know that. I don't think I've ever been.
So anyway.
I've seen it. I've seen it, but I've never been to it. But
yeah, he was the son. He was the son of the last minister of the church. And he was sitting homeless on the bench with his wife. I don't know the circumstances because I don't ask people about the circumstances. I just know they had no blankets and were sleeping on a bench. I'm not exaggerating. I'm telling you the truth. Whenever I tell you something, Robert, that means that's what it is.
So how long ago was this, Helga?
Yeah, I would say maybe a couple of months into when we first, I was with my husband and my two children. When we first moved here, and it was about 35 years ago.
What did your family make of your caring for homeless folks and your interest in them?
They're pretty much proud of their mother. They know my background. They know why I'm doing it. They understand me. And my granddaughter in school told them about me. She's now 8, and she said that her grandmother is helping the homeless. And then the teacher talked about it. And then they all agreed they would do something for the homeless. So, no, my family's right behind me. They love it.
Mm-hmm. Did you encounter...
I have 5 kids, okay?
Did you encounter much hostility in Felton around your homeless service work?
Well, not really, unless they came to my property. Then the neighbors, and I was very careful not to bring them to the property because I already knew what my neighbors would, what they think of homeless people. But once in a while, and it still happens, when they come to my property, either they work, you know, they work for me and I pay them, the neighbors don't really like homeless people on Plateau Drive. Mm. I live on Plateau, right up where you are, in the parallel to 9. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Now, I have to be careful, and I talked to both of my, I have 2 renters, and I told them, whenever they see people on my property, that means that I told them they could be there and that they're safe. You know, I had to make that clear to anyone that ever lived there, because they do come to my property once in a while, and especially if they work. Did you work for me?
Now, Helga, in the course of your 35 years, it sounds like you've hired folks occasionally. In fact, you told me that you had someone today working on your property.
I do. Mr. Gale, right right now.
Yeah, and so that's something that's a continuing job,
yeah.
A job opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
It's a job opportunity for them, and
yes.
And also it's an opportunity for you to get some work done that you need done. How often, let's say on a weekly basis throughout that 35 years, have you regularly done this, or is this an occasional thing?
No. I have one particular person, or now I have two or three, but one particular person who came from the Czech Republic. He was a part of the overthrowing the communism
mm-hmm.
in America, let him come in. So he built me a little apartment next to my house so I can rent it out so I have extra income. And he did the whole thing. He's a professional remodeler, and he did the whole thing. And he also for me fixes doors, mm-hmm. windows, he fixes my floors, he fixes plumbing, and I pay him. I don't pay him as much as I do a plumber, but I also give him clothes and sleeping bags besides money. You know, money is a little bit iffy because I don't know if they, you know, I mean, I don't know if they use it for drugs, but I'm not judging them, whatever they need to do, but it's safer for me to, you know, to give them things in return also.
Now, are these people, how long did your relationship continue with them, or is it still continuing?
Oh, yeah. She came over 20, I don't know how long ago that was when they overthrew in Czechoslovakia. Communism, he was tired of it. Maybe
1989 or 90, 91,
yeah,
thereabouts.
No, he stayed that long.
Mm-hmm.
I think they call it amnesty. So he's almost 62 now, and he will get Social Security because he's protected.
Now, how many homeless folks would you estimate there are currently in Felton, if you have any idea?
Yeah, that's very difficult. Difficult because a lot of them come and go, and some of them I never ever see. They don't get any service from the resource center. They stay very hidden. So I have to ask Eric, you know, the guy that helps me find the people that I need. And Eric will come on Thursday because he... On Thursday to the meeting, because the sheriff, when he was charging his phone outside of the resource center, two sheriffs came and bothered him. They searched him. They took all his things out of his backpack. And when he told them that he was recharging his phone, it was the same thing again. They said, Are you paying for the electricity? That's at the resource center. And that man is going to come on Thursday if he keeps his word. And will tell you that. And they let him go.
So I was going to ask you more about the history, but let me jump ahead to one of the issues that came up at the last HUF meeting, the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom group that you and I were both at last Thursday. Which is that you've had a lot of concerns about cut off of services and harassment of homeless people,
yeah.
that has increased around the what's it called, the Mountain Resource Center.
That's correct, Mountain Resource Center. That's the name.
That's on Highway 9, kind of across from Rite Aid or thereabouts.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so what goes on there normally, and how long has it been in business?
Yeah, that's a very good question, how long they've been in business, because there was a time I have to ask Eric, when they gave them the showers and the washer and the dryer, and then after a year or I don't know how long, year or two, maybe, I'm not quite sure. They took it away for lack of funds. And then I went to that meeting where they were talking, you know, in the courthouse. They talked about the resource center and the funds, and I spoke to them about it, that they have no showers, have no dryer, no washing. And I said, I just told them that I thought they live like animals, worse. And they said, okay, nice, whatever. They don't make much. They were doing comments, but they weren't really impressed with what I had to say. It didn't seem to matter because they don't know what it means to be muddy and dirty living in the woods and, you know, by the river. They have no idea. So, and yeah. And then I found out maybe 3 months ago that they have funds again. I find it out from Eric, who goes every day to charge his phone.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, my helper. And he said, Corey said they have funds 3 months ago, but they're looking for people to clean their showers, but cannot find anybody.
Now, who is Corey exactly?
Corey is the one, she's one of the managers. I gave you the card and you have it.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other one is Sandy. I think Sandy might be the one that manages, but I don't have any connection with her. I met Corey at the courthouse. And we talked about the funds for showers.
This is down in Santa Cruz at the courthouse?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I understand you've also been attending some of the court cases of homeless folks who have been facing harassment and prosecution in court for what we call homeless, so-called quality of life. Maybe we can call it quality of death offenses. You know, things like, I don't know, stealing power by plugging in your phone to a power source, sleeping outside, walking across the street called jaywalking, that sort of thing. Being in a closed area, even though no one's using it, stuff that's used against homeless people to scare them away.
Yeah, and 2 days ago, it was on Thursday when I was at the meeting. I've been taking care of someone for about 25 years or so. I am his representative. You know, I was chosen by his mother and the judge to take care of his money. I have some kind of connection with him because she was dating my daughter when she was very, very young, only for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And when she left him, he tried to commit suicide, and I helped him. I stopped him from, you know, committing suicide. And then, so he has SSI because of that, but he's homeless now.
And more about this after this musical break.
Stay.
And that was Stop Thief by Kristen Lems from her album Where Do the Animals Go, 1986 song. I like a few of her songs. This one I thought would have more punch to it because I didn't hear all of it before I played it for you. It's a little bit schmaltzy, but I thought it was going to be Get the Fuck Out of My Heart, Motherfucker, but no. You know, was everything turns up rosy and fluffy and so forth, which it's okay if that depicts a real experience, but I think it's more an imagined and hopeful experience rather than something real. And I prefer, at least, I think the real leads ultimately to the ideal, or the better, anyway. Anyway, let's get back to some real experiences by Helga of Felton.
So he has SSI because of that, but he's homeless now since over a year. He lost his home after the, you know, with the pandemic. He lived there maybe for 5 years with his girlfriend, and long story short, they kicked him out. He was on the street and got drunk the same day when the trucks came and picked up all his belongings, and now they arrested him again on Thursday. And the reason they arrested him, he has some kind of ticket outstanding that he's been going for 2 years every month to court, and he doesn't comply. He does not agree with the what they want him to keep guilty, and he doesn't. He missed one time, 2 years or three years.
Mm-hmm.
One time after the big rain, he didn't have any clothing. He didn't know what his state was. They came, arrested him on Thursday, right at the resource center, and he's in jail now since Thursday.
Now, the resource center itself was one of the issues you brought up at the Huff meeting, and also in conversations with me in the last few weeks. You are concerned that even though the money has been restored for the restoration of showers and so forth, that service has not been restored. Is that your concern?
Yeah, of course, because that's a very, very important part of in the very poor. You know, life, not having any warm food, not being able to sleep normal, like normal people do. And then now they took away the thing that kind of helped them to take. And right now, cold weather, you know, you live in Felton, and they took away the showers and took away the dryer, very important, and washer, so they can wash their clothing after it gets all dirty and muddy. And the showers just keep them feel like more like a human being.
So, the mountain, you're not sure how long the Mountain Resource Center has been supplying these services before they cut it off?
No, you know what? A lot of people, they didn't use it for showers. The showers might have only been maybe a couple of years. What they did mainly, they still do that. They help people with the taxes or people for, you know, to get SSI or to get food stamps, you know. So they help. That's more what they used to do. But then once they got showers and a dryer, washer and a dryer, they became more busy.
So has there been an influx of homeless folks into Felton in the last year or two?
I think a lot of people have left because of the sheriff. Very many people have left, and some people come and go. But it looked like with the Kent City down, people that used to be in Felton have come back. I don't know how many. I just know that I see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come back because that's where they came from to begin with.
If people wanted to meet and talk with homeless people in Felton, are there places where they should go to meet them?
I think the homeless people are extremely reluctant to talk to people that they don't know.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, they talk to me no problem because they know me for so long, mm-hmm. and they know I'm safe, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because I am even the representative, I have to be honest to you know, give him his money and pay for whatever I have to pay for. So they know me, but they don't just, I don't think they just talk to people that come along and want to interview them.
Now, I'm more interested in people, not so much who are going out to and looking for interviews, but I'm just wondering, are there places where folks gather that if, well, let's say if you were a charity service and you wanted to give out sandwiches or you wanted to...
Yeah. You know what? I think our Catholic Church, who gives them one hot meal a week, I think it's on Thursday also, when they receive the food from the, you know, not from the resource center, but at the resource center. So the Catholic Church, after they pick up, you know, the hamburger buns and the hot dogs that you have to eat cold because you can't cook it, you know, so that they give them one hot meal a week for them, only one hot meal.
And what time of day does this happen?
Same day as the resource center. As they get food from at the resource, not from the, that's private, has nothing to do with the resource center, but the resource center, that's where they get it.
What time of day?
I'm sorry?
What time of day?
I would say Thursday, 9, 10 to about 12, 1, and then 1 o'clock, it's a Catholic church across the street going towards, you know, on Highway 9, going towards Santa Cruz on the other side. The farmer's market is there every Wednesday.
Yeah, it's across from the Quick Stop gas station.
Yeah, correct. That's what you can see, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So that's where they get, I've been there many times. And they're nice people, the Catholic Church, but nobody is really coming up with any kind of solution to where they can get a couple of meals, or three meals, or hot meals somewhere, like they do at Food Not Bombs. You know, I talked to them and said that would be nice if somebody could come and give them maybe three times a week a warm meal at least, because, yeah, and so, yeah, that's...
Yeah, that would be nice.
That would be wonderful.
So, what would you say that there are many other folks like yourself who give a shit about homeless folks in the Felton area? And if so, do they ever get together? Do you see much of them? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, like Gloria said something to me, and it made a lot of sense to me. In Felton, all the way in the mountains, people are actually very prejudiced towards homeless people.
You mean against them?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. when they cleared the park out by the covered bridge, I remember I heard that, I thought I got it from Sheriff Dunn, because I have a good relationship with Sheriff Dunn, who's the sheriff in Felton. But they said that the people who live around that park or who live in Felton, they are the ones that they're saying that wanted the homeless people out of the park. And now there's some old people and everybody walks their little dogs, their big dogs, but no homeless people. So it's a dog walking park now.
Mm-hmm.
They made that. They created that. But they, when I say they blamed it on whoever I talked to, maybe the sheriff, they blamed it on the people who live in Fountain, who complained, and who wanted that park cleared out from the homeless people.
Well, the sheriffs can choose to ignore complaints that violate the civil rights of other people if they want, or they can get active and enforce the bigotry that's involved. That's their choice, you know.
That's what happened.
What have you noticed about the progress of the sheriff's department's behavior, let's say, in your 35 years here?
Well, all I have to do is talk to the poor homeless people, and they... You know, that guy Eric that's helping me that I try to bring on Thursday to the meeting, they are afraid of the sheriffs. They hide from them because they know. They know them. They can say anything they want to and make it a law against them. And give them warrants, okay? Give them warrants for arrest. They can use whatever. They all know that, Robert. They're not that dumb, you know? Most of them are actually very smart.
So there hasn't been much change, or would you say that you've seen a change in the course of the last 30 years?
Change in what?
The sheriff's behavior in the Felton area toward folks outside.
Well, I just can tell you, before that, before they cleared the park, you know, just fanatically, whatever, every day, sheriffs came and told them they cannot do this, they cannot do that. Before that, I remember that there's some horror stories. You know, it's an old woman I took care of her for many years too. She was under the big stone bridge. But there was a big rain came and the river came up. She went under the wooden bridge, okay? And I told that to Sheriff Dunn. She went under the wooden bridge. And I brought her a sleeping bag and blankets, and she lay down just to be covered. And a sheriff came when it was dark. I wasn't there anymore, and told her to leave. Can I be under, you know, under the roof of the wooden bridge? She was safe there and dry. So those stories happened over and over and over again. And the Czech guy, his name is Tonta, the guy that is helping me building me an apartment. He has been building little tiny wooden places for him, like a tent, for many, many years, 20 years, as long as he's been here. And they also come around, find it, and tell him to move on. He was in Boulder Creek now for 2 years, and about 2 months ago, the sheriff came and told him he has to take everything down and leave. So now he's back in Charlton, and he's outdoors again. He doesn't have a tent. The last tent I got from Keith, I gave it to that guy who's in jail right now. You know, his name is Everardo. I'm the representative of my mother. I gave him the last tent. But Tonda, they've been harassing him for a long time. Whenever he built a place away from everything, not in the way, they come and give him a notice, and then you give him a notice maybe 1 month. So he took down, you know, the little thing he built out of boards, hidden away, I saw it, and they told him to leave. And now it's in Felton, and it's totally drunk, high on drugs. He said, I lost my home again. That's what he told me. Now I know what he means. He lost his home. He lost a place that he's been there now for over 2 years. And before that, he had one in Felton. And the same thing happened. They told him to tear down that little place and move on. And then he went to Boulder Creek. So that's been going on forever, Robert, forever.
Would you say, Helga, that it's easier for homeless folks in Ben Lomond and Boulder Creek than it is in Felton?
Ben Lomond, I don't know anything about. It's always Boulder Creek. That's where there are some, but very hidden also. They're hidden. But they came, Tonda went there because they were chased out of Felton.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably She told me it was easier in Boulder Creek because the sheriffs are not quite as strict as they are in Felton. But they still caught him too, you know, like a month ago whenever he had to tear down the fences. They actually had a beautiful place. It was like a little shrine. All made it really beautiful. And so now he's homeless again.
So
he calls it, he says, houseless.
Yeah, it's the same sheriff's department, of course, in Felton and in Boulder Creek and in Santa Cruz and in, you know, all the throughout the county. That's the it's the county department. So.
Kind of like him. He has a good heart, Jason Pang. Is he a sheriff of in Boulder Creek also?
I don't know the individual sheriffs. I know that, as far as I know, there's police departments for four cities, Santa Cruz, Watsonville, Scotts Valley, and I think there's one other city. But the rest of the other cities, like Davenport and Ben Lomond, maybe Boulder Creek. I don't think Boulder Creek has a sheriff's department, but I could be wrong. And breaking into this conversation, it's music time. Fluffy song was "Oh Little Bird" by Kristen Lems,
from her album You, Me, and All of the Above.
Oh, I don't think so.
I know that Scotts Valley does, but anyway, what I'm saying is that the Sheriff's Department has the same, you know, they have policies, and I suppose individual sheriffs who are temporarily in charge of different areas, I don't know if they assign sheriffs permanently to one area. Maybe they do, maybe they don't.
Do you know what Dunn says, Jason Dunn?
I don't know any.
He's been there for a long time, Robert.
Okay,
he's been in that office, right by Safeway.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you go around the corner and before you get the bridge.
I'm familiar with it,
you know where the office is, the sheriff's office, right?
Yeah, so she's frequently there.
Yeah, he's been there for a long time. We know. The homeless people like him also.
Right. What I'm saying is, though, that I don't know that necessarily the sheriffs who patrol these areas aren't, in fact, going into multiple jurisdictions. And
when they did that with the cleaning out the park, they had all the sheriffs coming from Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
There wasn't time.
Your concern, I think, a lot of the concern you had initially when you came to our meeting was, you spoke to me on the phone, was to find some way to encourage or even pressure the management of the Mountain Resource Center to start supplying the resources that it's getting paid to supply by private donations. Is that accurate?
What I'm saying, Helga, is that
if they're getting money to do this, wherever they're getting it from, apparently homeless folks aren't getting access to the showers, right?
No.
Your concern is that these showers be restored.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Not only the showers, but the washer and dryer.
Right.
Not, a lot of people live without washers and dryers, but they're not homeless. You know, when you're homeless, you cannot go to a laundromat and spend $20, twice a week. You don't have the money.
Mm-hmm.
At a regular laundromat, it's expensive, the drying and the washing. But they had it before. They said the funds were out. They had it all, and it was good. The morals, the morale of the people were much happier, cleaner, and now the problem is with the cold weather, freezing this morning. If they can get a hot shower, they can get warm and clean. Again.
Have you spoken to many of the other homeless folks who want to use the showers that they used to use or that they've heard had been usable?
They all do. Maybe some of them only once a week. Some of them three times as much as they offer. They would go, I know the guy, Verado, that I take care of, he's super, super clean and she took shower three times a week and washed his clothes.
I believe you.
Couldn't go to court. That's why they arrested him. Couldn't go to court because he would not go in muddy, dirty clothes to the court. They arrested him the night after he missed his date.
In any case, the reason I ask that is there a time and a place where these folks would gather where you might be able to get some, say, a petition that they would sign that indicating that they...
Oh, yeah, I can do that. I pay Eric. I pay Eric for little services like that. I pay him, a little bit. And then he goes around. He will do it. I have him do it. He knows where everybody is. But you cannot find them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I can get enough.
Well, I just think it's I think it's a good thing to encourage people to know that they're not alone in what they're trying to do, that other people have the same needs, that it's quite reasonable. They're not some sort of unreasonable, screamy, crazy person, you know, that's making unreasonable demands, but that rather they're an ordinary human being that's looking to be treated with basic decency. And more important, that there are others just like them who are seeking the same thing. And as they say, they can break a finger, but it's a little harder to break a fist, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, of course. But then, Robert, it's not that easy to...
Oh, I know, I know.
Homeless people find a paper, because that one guy, Matthew, see, there's so many there. You know, Matthew, when I told him to come with me to, you know, to the group, to a house, he said, are you kidding me? And then he has all the sheriffs after me.
I understand.
I mean, that's the attitude.
The other thing... I understand, Ilga. I know that that's likely the case, and you're telling me it is the case. But I guess I'm wondering. I've heard of other homeless resource areas. I guess Annette Markham. I don't know, up in Ben Lomond. That places there are service providers who get paid to supposedly they get paid by private groups, sometimes some by government groups, to. You know, provide stuff to homeless folks. I mean, that is the theory on which, you know, the reason they provide this money is that so that homeless people don't appear in public places, so they can disappear more, you know, more easily and not be seen and not embarrass people by, you know, starving outside the windows while others are eating in fancy restaurants. That being the case, what I'm saying is that because there are these service providers that have these homeless clients, they might be a group that can help you in your quest to get these at this one place, these showers and turned on, maybe less harassment by somebody using electricity. I mean, even down in the benchlands, what you would call Tent City in the San Lorenzo Park benchlands, the city put in electrical things for people to charge their phones.
Yes.
And they only did that after the Santa Cruz Homeless Union and courts intervened. But in fact, when people come together, there is more chance of it. And also when service providers start doing it, although service providers seem now intent on just simply shoveling people into their programs and leaving the rest of the people out to hang out to dry, I guess is the way to put it.
Yeah.
So,
I understand what you're saying.
So what I'm saying is if you go to some of those groups, not in an official capacity necessarily, but sort of hang around and see what, you know, I guess churches are the most obvious place to go, different churches, to see...
I've done that, yeah. I do the Catholic Church, and I talk to them.
There must be...
I hang out with the homeless when they get home there.
There are dozens...
to the ministers. They're not... I'm not interested.
Hold it. I'm not interested in the ministers. I'm talking about the congregation and the people. That's the people you've got to talk to, not the people who are running the church. They don't give a shit, or they've got, you know, they got other priorities. If they give a shit, that doesn't show much.
I don't think I hear what you're saying, Robert, but I'm telling you again, people in the mountain area, they're really not that interested in homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they live their own little sweet life. Like when I go into my bedroom and I have my beautiful down blanket, I cannot go to sleep. I have to sit on my bed and pray. You know, because I know where they are staying. It's wet and cold, freezing, and their blankets get wet, but people don't care. Even the people who obviously, the certain people got rid of the homeless people in the park. I don't know anything about Ben Lomond. Couldn't be any better than that. I never heard anybody from Boulder Creek say anything about Ben Lomond. But Boulder Creek, I know a couple of people. They seem to be doing a little bit better, but it's smaller than Charlton. the homeless group is smaller. But I don't trust the people here about homeless people. People don't like homeless people, Robert.
Well, I hear what you're saying, you know, Helga, and you would know. You've been out there, you know, doing the kind of stuff and expressing the kind of feeling that embarrasses, I'm sure, other people and makes them want to turn the other way and dismiss you or say, yep. There you go, here's a dollar, now go on your way, please, you know, that sort of thing.
Yep, and actually, it's not even their fault because a lot of people have never experienced what those poor people experience, and if they never experience it, they don't know what it is like, and they don't go under the bridge like I do. But I know what it is like, so it's not their fault. It's just the callousness of society right now. Okay, that's what I can tell you.
Yeah, it's true. Well, Helga, I'm going to wind this one down because we've gone through some points.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, we haven't really gotten to the you and I and I guess some other Huff members are going to work on presenting some concerns in a more formal fashion and getting more information from the Mountain Resource Group, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And if anybody's listening who lives in Felton or the San Lorenzo Valley who wants to be involved, give a call to the Huff line at 831-423-4833. That's my number. I'll put you in touch with Helga, unless you want to give out your number, Helga. You can if you want, but I can...
I don't care who you want to give it to.
Well, it would go out to anybody listening.
Oh, yeah. No, I do. That's not a problem. I talked the other day to a woman that I knew for a very long time, and she volunteered to help me with whatever I...
Well, why don't you put out...
Santa Cruz.
Why don't you give me... Yeah, why don't you put out your number then? Go ahead.
Yeah, I can do that.
Go for it.
You want me to say it?
Yeah. Just say it.
Yeah. Okay, I'm Helga. My phone number is
316-6294. That's 316-6294. Give Helga a call. If you don't get her, get hold. Call me up, 423-4833. That's 423-HUFF if you have one of those old phones. That's how you get me. And otherwise, 316, and what's the last number part of it, Helga?
316-6294.
There you go. And, let's hope your compassion is something that is contagious, because that's the kind of contagion we'd like to see.
I hope so, too, and I will not give up, because there is a part of humanity that still is good and kind and loving, but I see too many things now. As life is here in America, people are too busy and with their earning money and being selfish, and that's the majority as I see it. But there is still, and I hope the people who care and have a loving heart for the poor,
you okay there, Helga?
I'm okay.
All right, babe. Yeah, remember, it's, as you were saying, people, even those sheriffs with their guns who are driving people out of the parks, you know, they are, you know, they're human beings, too. The trouble is they're a part of an inhuman social organization, and they're following a set of inhuman priorities. That's the problem, as I see it.
I know there's nothing much we can do, but we can work from wherever we are at this point in our lives. We can work, and the main priority is just to help to ease the life of the poor, the hungry, and the cold, see what they need. That's so simple. You know, I don't have a lot of money, but whatever I have, I'm willing to share it with others, and that's it. I'm willing to share. I have shared with the homeless.
Indeed. And I'm going to wind it up. I'm going, but I think, you know, you made your case. So.
It's a beautiful sky. I'm in Henry Carl Park. It's really beautiful, Robin. You should see how beautiful it is.
Well, you enjoy, and I will talk to you again soon. I'll probably call you to do the rest of the stuff. I'm going to send you a list of people that you can call.
And, you know, feel free to call me if you have I don't want to bother you when I'm really, really upset about the whole thing. Then I don't call you when I'm really upset.
It's okay, babe. Call me when you want.
Yeah, you don't want to cry.
Your call is welcome.
But I'm glad you're behind me, or I'm in your group.
Well, I'm certainly in the background, if nothing else.
Yeah, I know.
All right, babe. Take care.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
So here's a grim story from today's San Francisco Chronicle entitled, Two Shot, One Impaled with Sword in Eviction Battle, by Rachel Swan. A stunning confrontation in a Vallejo trailer yard left two people shot and an 80-year-old man impaled with a sword early Sunday morning, according to a witness who said he found the man soaked in blood. He came banging on my door with a sword sticking through him, said Patrick McMillan, a tenant who lives in a mobile home on the property, and described the stabbing victim as his landlord and best friend. Police said they headed to the lot on the 600 block of 3rd Street at 7:24 a.m. after receiving reports, this is in Vallejo, that a man had been attacked. When they arrived, they found the stabbed property owner, who McMillan identified as Kurt Lind, as well as two people suffering from gunshot wounds. McMillan said that Lind shot the two people as they attacked him. One of the people shot, a 31-year-old Vallejo resident, died at the scene, while the other had to be rushed to the hospital along with Lind. Both of them were in critical condition, police said. Officers said they arrested a suspect and are trying to ascertain the person's, quote, true identity. Police have released few details about the case, saying they're investigating the motive and circumstances that led up to the bloodshed. The burst of violence apparently stemmed from an eviction battle that had recently escalated. McMillan said, adding that he believes Sonoma County Sheriff's deputies were scheduled to move several people from the property on Tuesday morning. Lind had purchased the lot at the edge of the Napa River, filling it with 20-foot trailers and shipping containers so that he could rent them to people who couldn't afford the cost of housing in Vallejo, McMillan said. Besides providing a cheap dwelling, or a slum, perhaps, if you want to look at it that way, Lind wanted tenants to have space to start a business, according to McMillan. Lind lived on the property in his own trailer, McMillan said, and then often picked up trash from the surrounding streets. The group he was attempting to evict lived in a cluster of trailer trucks, McMillan said, and initially paid rent, but stopped at some point during the pandemic. After McMillan took steps to remove them, they began brandishing knives and throwing rocks into Lynn's trailer from a nearby hill. He had an agreement that they were going to fix up their vehicles, and then they were going to leave, Lynn's daughter, Dina Morrill, said on Wednesday, during a phone interview from the local hospital where her father is slowly recovering. She said the squatters, instead of holding up their end of the deal, stayed put and ultimately overtook the property, placing locks on trailers that were intended for other people. My dad always thinks the best of people, and unfortunately some people take advantage of that, Morrill said. What he thought was a good idea turned into a nightmare. On the night of the attack, McMillan said, he saw individuals running through the yard with headlamps. At some point, a distressed Lind called and said people were pummeling his door and windows with rocks. McMillan believes that multiple people tackled Lind and stabbed him. As of Wednesday, Lind was conscious but still in severe pain, Morrill said, with a tube in his chest and numerous staples and stitches on his face and back. She anticipates he may go blind in his right eye after an unsuccessful surgery. She has set him up a GoFundMe page to assist with his medical bills. Anyone with information regarding the incident is asked to contact Vallejo Police Detective Ken Jackson or Brian Murphy in their phone numbers. And that's a story by Rachel Swain San Francisco Chronicle staff. So this story is only a couple of days old. And with my usual skeptical eye, I read the story wondering about the story of the tenants who were being driven out by the man who got stabbed with a sword and then shot three people, one of them, a woman, dead. That was the guy who did the shooting. And the guy who was stabbed with the sword was Kurt Lind, who is the apparently the landlord. I'm wondering what the rents were that he was charging, what kind of conditions he had for these large storage lockers that were serving as cheap space for people to live in. Normally, normally a 20-foot trailer and shipping container isn't really rentable as a living space. I don't know what the Vallejo rules are, and I'm not really that familiar with state requirements for residency in, shipping containers, if that's what's happening. A lot of the story's aspects are a little unclear, but I tend to start thinking in lines of, did the tenants have any justification for what they did? Were there reasons they were throwing rocks at him? And why didn't the reporter in question and the other reporters, who essentially are reporting this story, I looked over the matter online, and it's mostly a repetition of the same witness, Patrick McMillan, and I guess there's one other person quoted here, the daughter, Lynn's daughter, Dina Morell. So, I mean, I don't really know what went on, and I haven't found out yet, so what am I doing talking about it? I guess it's an example of what I think a media slant is, and the people the media chooses to actually talk to. Here's another story from Vallejo. It's not about folks in a trailer. It's about the eviction or attempted eviction of an encampment. And it's from the Vallejo Sun of October 4th, about a month and a half ago. Unhoused Vallejo residents resisting camp eviction. The residents have vowed to fight yet another eviction, demanding the city provide services and viable options to live rather than continually evicting them. And here's some more of the story. Vallejo. Residents of a Vallejo homeless encampment have signed a federal complaint seeking to prevent the city from evicting them from a vacant lot near Austin Creek, alleging that police send them from place to place and destroy their possessions, sound familiar, Santa Cruzans, while giving them no support or options for housing. About 20 people have been living in the camp just off State Highway 37 and Sacramento Street for several months. It is not accessible or visible from the road, and residents say they have received no complaints from neighbors who have occasionally provided the people living there with supplies. But Vallejo police posted 72-hour eviction notices there last week, citing state and city anti-camping ordinances. And it should be said here, I never saw any listing of specific complaints that required the city to immediately drive Santa Cruz City to immediately drive people from the benchlands. No documentation of a specific complaint problem. A vague statement about how they were in a floodplain and it might rain at some point in the future, not clear when. I think they had one small rain during that period of time. So it seems an analogous situation. Vallejo police posted 72-hour eviction notices there last week, citing state and city anti-camping ordinances. It is not clear from county records who owns the property. Vallejo police did not respond to a request for clarification of the reason for the eviction. At least the media asked about that. Didn't hear Jessica York of the Sentinel doing any asking about the specifics that required this immediate eviction after the city had sat on its hands and essentially denied services, occasionally harassed Food Not Bombs supplying food. For 2 years, they'd essentially had no explicit and ostensible problems with the benchlands encampment, but then suddenly they had to move in on it to grow the grass again before the winter. I mean, it's a key issue, I guess. Although they didn't say that was their objective, but that seems to be what they're spending $1 million doing. Moving the folks out into temporary shelters, some of them, and essentially dispersing the majority to nowhere, or everywhere, if you will. And then that those that get moved into temporary shelter are going to have to move out. And they're not going to move into real shelter or housing, the overwhelming majority of them. At least if the past is any indication. And the housing market doesn't look like it's about to change in the near future, as far as I know, although I'm no expert in that. The reasons the residents have vowed in Vallejo to fight yet another eviction, demanding the city provide services and viable options to live rather than continually evicting them. Notice also that there's a certain decency and dignity provided by this writer of the story. He talks about as residents. Now, if I were to check Jessica York's story, so in looking over a September 14th story by Jessica York, eviction begins at Santa Cruz homeless camp in the Santa Cruz Sentinel, I find the words homeless encampment. I find the words occupant repeated numerous times, but nowhere are they referred to as residents. See, they just haven't yet acquired that status in the mind of Jessica York. Could be she uses a different terminology. But an occupant is different than a resident. And that seems to be the language that she uses, at least in this story. So, again, displaced occupant. And that's the way they are described by York in the story. Let's get back to Vallejo, however. On Monday, the Vallejo residents signed a complaint to be filed on their own behalf in U.S. District Court, arguing that they have been refused shelter elsewhere. There is no viable location that wouldn't be subject to further eviction, and they have made substantial efforts to not cause harm to the community. They say they pick up trash, and fires and crime have not been a problem there. They can't just evict people and treat people the way they're treating people, said Barbara Dorsey, who said she has lived at the camp for 3 months. This is a crisis out here, and it needs to be addressed instead of just being swept under the rug, and they just bully the homeless. Dorsey said she has been homeless for about 6 to 8 months. She said she started losing control of her life after Vallejo police killed her brother, Willie McCoy, in the drive-thru of a Taco Bell in February 2019. McCoy was found asleep in his car, allegedly with a gun in his lap, when 6 police officers shot at him 55 times. That's what the story says. Dorsey said she works as an in-home caregiver, but she's had trouble keeping the job because she doesn't have a home. At one point, she said she was sleeping in her car, which scared her because of the way her brother died, but Vallejo police solved that problem by towing it. The towing fees were so expensive that the family she does caregiving for bought her a new car so she could get to work. During an eviction, Dorsey said the police routinely destroy her possessions. If you came to any of the 8 brutal evictions from the San Lorenzo campground, by brutal, I don't mean brutal in terms of physical assaults on the campers. I mean the destruction of property by bulldozers and diggers with claws, and trashing of actual possessions was just notorious, regular, and treated as a ho-hum kind of norm. So, like Vallejo, like Santa Cruz. During an eviction, to repeat, Dorsey said the police routinely destroy her possessions, like tents, clothes, and food, with no clear way to recover it. The city's eviction notice says the city will make a reasonable effort to identify personal property and store it for at least 90 days, which they're required to do by law, which is also what the Santa Cruz police did in the San Lorenzo encampment, the Benchlands encampment demolition. But Dorsey said each time she's been evicted, her possessions have been thrown into the trash. And one could observe the same thing happening in the Benchlands. time after time. Courts have held that cities can't criminalize homelessness or destroy people's possessions in camp cleanups. In one case in Boise, Idaho, the famous Martin versus Boise case, I suspect, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the city could not enforce anti-camping laws if there was no shelter available. Last year, Caltrans agreed to reimburse more than 1,000 people in Oakland and Berkeley for destroyed property as part of a class action settlement. The city of Vallejo has promised to construct a new navigation center, but as of May, the city had not started building it, and the budget had ballooned from $2.3 million to, wait for it, $9 million. Days after those revelations to the city council, housing manager Judy Shepherd Hall was placed on administrative leave. The city of Vallejo directs people evicted from camps to the Christian Help Center, a 75-bed facility, just like here in Santa Cruz. People are directed to the Armory or the Overlook, or in rarer cases to the 1220 River Street or to the Coral Street, the 115 Coral Street, so-called Housing Matters Complex. But residents say the Christian Help Center in Vallejo is frequently full. The most recent survey of homeless residents conducted in Solano County in 2019 found there were 1,151 people who were homeless and 81% lacked shelter. Half reported living in Vallejo at some point during the previous year. Dorsey said in her current camp, residents are responsible and look out for each other. They are asking the city to help them with resources like trash pickup and porta-potties so they can keep the area clean. And, of course, the city's response to this was incredibly inadequate in Santa Cruz, where they had hundreds of people and 9 porta-potties. Maybe 10, I don't know. When you get into a community like this one where everybody's mature adults, people work here. Nobody's just sitting around hanging out, Dorsey said. We all watch over each other's stuff, so nothing is left unattended. No idea. Being a part of a community, I know in Santa Cruz, theft between folks in camps was a significant problem. Being a part of a community is a blessing because I'm usually by myself and having somebody who will look out for me when I'm sleeping without having to worry about getting raped or robbed or something. It is a blessing, Dorsey said. Everybody works together here. If I can't afford food or something one day, somebody is going to make sure they feed you. And the story says the article has been updated to note that the complaint to the federal court was not able to be properly filed on Monday, but is expected to be filed soon. And this story is dated October 4th from the Vallejo Sun, unhoused Vallejo residents resisting camp eviction. And I don't really know if there was an injunction either sought for or actually received. Let me see. So very brief Google search doesn't reveal there was an injunction either filed or granted by the court. Let's get one of the musical breaks while we still have a little time left in the show.
Bobby, reason with the woman. I'm a little short this morning.
He's my pa, Miss Pennywise. Can he come in for free just this once?
Get your head out of the clouds, Bobby Strong. No one gets in for free. Every morning you all come here, and every morning some of you got reasons why you ain't gonna pay. And I'm here to tell you, you is gonna pay.
In the name of God, Penny, what difference could it make?
What difference? Times are hard, our cash is tight, you've got no rights, I've heard it all before. Just this once is once too much, cause once leave once, the water once, once more. I run the only toilet in this part of town, you see. So if you gotta go, you gotta go through me. It's a privilege to be. Water's worth its weight in gold these days. No more bathrooms like in olden days. You come here and pay a fee for the privilege to pee. 20 years we've had the drought, and our reservoirs have all dried up. I take my baths now in a coffee cup. I boil what's left of it for tea. education. So come and give your coins to me. Write your name here in the record book. The authorities will want to look if you've been regular with me. If you've paid the proper fee for the privilege to pee. I said, no buts, Bobby. You're a sweet-looking boy, and I'd like to keep you around. But this man ain't coming in without paying. Not this time!
I can't wait much longer, Bobby. There's no telling what I might do.
You think you got some kind of a right? You think you come in here and go for free? The only thing you'll get is no for free. I'm a business gal, you see. I sell the privilege to be. Charge you twice.
No need to jeopardize your position.
Or better yet, have you arrested?
I'm through with all this, you see.
If you prefer the law gets tested.
Scraping cash three times a day.
In town, you'll see.
Crazy with a nitro tap a time.
To fight for me.
It's no way to live, I tells you. No way to live.
For the
most of that song from the musical Urinetown is quite audible, but I'm going to run through the lyrics just because some of it wasn't. Bobby, Bobby, reason with the woman. I'm a little short this morning. He's my pa, Miss Pennywise. Can't he come in for free just this once? Get your head out of the clouds, Bobby Strong. No one gets in for free. Every morning you all come here, and every morning some of you got reasons why you ain't going to pay. And I'm here to tell you, ya is going to pay. In the name of God, Penny, what difference could it make? What difference? Times is hard, our cash is tight, you've got no right, I've heard it all before. Just this once is once too much, because once they've once, they want to once more. I run the only toilet in this part of town, you see, so if you've got to go, you've got to go through me. It's a privilege to pee. Water's worth its weight in gold these days. No more bathrooms like in olden days. You come here and pay a fee for the privilege to pee. 20 years we've had the drought, and our reservoirs have all dried up. I take my baths now in a coffee cup. I boil what's left of it for tea, and it's a privilege to pee. The politicians in their wisdom saw that there should be a law. The politicians taxed the toilets and made illegal public urination and defecation. So come and give your coins to me. Write your name here in the record book. The authorities will want to look if you've been regular with me, if you paid the proper fee for the privilege to pee. But, Miss Pennywise, I said no buts, Bobby. You're a sweet-looking boy, and I likes to keep you around, but this man ain't coming in without paying, not this time. I can't wait much longer, Bobby. There's no telling what I might do. You think you've got some kind of right, kind of right, kind of right. You think you'll come in here and go for free, snag a freebie. The only thing you'll get is no for free. Negatory. I'm a business gal, you see. Business gal, you see. I sell the privilege to pee. The poor, it's a privilege to pee. The good Lord made us so we'd piss each day until we piss away. The good Lord made sure that what goes in men must come out again. So you're no different than from lowly me, the poor me, lowly me, lowly me, lowly me. But Miss Pennywise, that's enough, Bobby. And I think I'll charge you twice. No need to jeopardize your position. Or better yet, have you arrested? I'm through with all this, you see. Since you prefer the law gets tested, scraping cash three times a day, and in Urinetown you'll see, crazy with the nitrates half the time. Why, it's dumb to fight with me. It's no way to live, I tell you, no way to live. for the privilege to pee. So I think I'm going to conclude this netcast, because I'm running out of time, frankly, with a story by Caitlin Johnstone, as read by, not sure who reads it, but Tim Foley, I guess it is. And the name of the story is Journalistic Responsibility Vanishes When Reporting on U.S. Targeted Nations, Going Rogue, with Caitlin Johnstone. And I'm very concerned with the escalating war in the Ukraine against, well, between Russia and the NATO powers is really what it boils down to. Ukraine is just, you know, the killing ground where it's happening. Anyway, here's some of that. At least there's a story that recently came out. Two false news reports have gone viral in recent hours due to sloppy sourcing and journalistic malpractice. As usual, they both featured bogus claims about U.S. targeted nations, in this case, Russia and Iran. And here's a reading of that story.
Journalistic responsibility vanishes when reporting on U.S. targeted nations. Two false news reports have gone viral in recent hours due to sloppy sourcing and journalistic malpractice. As usual, they both featured bogus claims about U.S. targeted nations, in this case, Russia and Iran. An article in Responsible Statecraft titled, How a Lightly Sourced AP Story Almost Set Off World War III, details how the propaganda multiplier news agency published a one-source, one-sentence report claiming that Russia had launched a deadly missile strike at NATO member Poland, despite evidence having already come to light by that point that the missile had probably come from Ukraine. This set off calls for the implementation of a NATO Article 5 response, meaning hot warfare between NATO and Russia in retaliation for a Russian attack on one of the alliance members. Mainstream news reports circulated the narrative that Poland had been struck by a Russian-made missile, which is at best a highly misleading framing of the fact that the inadvertent strike came from a Soviet-era surface-to-air missile system still used by Ukraine, a former Soviet state. Headlines from the largest and most influential U.S. news outlets like the New York Times, CNN, and NBC all repeated the misleading Russian-made framing, as did AP's own correction in its false report that Poland was struck by Russia. All current evidence indicates that Poland was accidentally hit by one of those missiles while Ukraine was defending itself from Russian missile strikes. President Biden said it's unlikely that the missile which killed two Poles came from Russia, while Polish President Andrzej Duda and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg both said it looks like it was an accidental strike from Ukrainian air defenses. Russia says its own missile strikes have been no closer than 35 kilometers from the Polish border. The only party still adamantly insisting that the strike did come from Russia is Ukraine, leading an exasperated diplomat from a NATO country to anonymously tell Financial Times, "This is getting ridiculous. The Ukrainians are destroying our confidence in them. Nobody is blaming Ukraine and they are openly lying. This is more destructive than the missile." It is very sleazy for AP to continue to protect the anonymity of the U.S. official who fed them a lie of such immense significance and potential consequence. They should tell the world who it was who initiated that lie so we can demand explanations and accountability. Another false story that went extremely viral was one that Newsweek had been forced to extensively revise and correct, that was initially titled, "Iran Votes to Execute Protesters, Says Rebels Need a Hard Lesson," but is now titled, "Iran Parliament Chants Death to Seditionists in Protest Punishment Call." The latest correction notice now reads, "The article and headline were updated to remove the reference to the Iranian parliament voting for death sentences. A majority of the parliament supported a letter to the judiciary calling for harsh punishments of protesters, which could include the death penalty." Moon of Alabama explains how the Newsweek piece was the springboard that launched the viral false claim that the Iranian government had just sentenced 15,000 protesters to death, which was circulated by countless politicians, pundits, and celebrities throughout social media. This claim has been debunked by mainstream outlets like NBC News, who explains that there has been no evidence that 15,000 protesters have been sentenced to death. Two protesters have been sentenced to death as of Tuesday, although they can appeal, according to state news agencies. An article by The Cradle titled Fact Check, Iran Has Not Sentenced 15,000 Protesters to Death, explains that the Iranian parliament actually just signed a letter urging the Iranian judiciary to issue harsher sentences upon protesters who've been demonstrating against Tehran. Those sentences can include the death penalty, as noted above, but up to this point have more often entailed prison sentences of 5 to 10 years. The Cradle also notes that even the 15,000 figure is suspect, as its sole source is an American organization funded by the U.S. government's National Endowment for Democracy. Quote, further muddying the waters, the figure of 15,000 protesters detained by Iranian authorities originates from the Human Rights Activists News Agency. U.S.-based HRANA is the media arm of the Human Rights Activists in Iran, HRAI, a group that receives funding from the National Endowment for Democracy, NED, a CIA soft power that has for decades funded regime change efforts across the globe, end quote. Indeed, it's public knowledge that NED is funded directly by the U.S. government, and that according to its own co-founder was set up to do overtly what the CIA used to do covertly. It's possible that the 15,000 figure could be more or less accurate, and it's possible that a great many more Iranian protesters will be sentenced to death for their actions. But reporting such possibilities as a currently established fact is plainly journalistic malpractice. In April of this year, Newsweek published an article titled, Russians Raped 11-Year-Old Boy Forced Mom to Watch, Ukraine Official. In May of this year, Newsweek published an article titled, Ukraine Official Fired Over Handling of Russian Sexual Assault Claims. It was the same official. Newsweek made no mention of the fact that its source for its sexual assault story had just been fired for disseminating unevidenced claims about sexual assault. To this day, its April report contains no updates or corrections. Contrast this complete dereliction of journalistic responsibility with Newsweek's extreme caution when one of its reporters tried to report on the OPCW scandal, which disrupted the U.S. government's narrative about an alleged chemical weapons attack by the Syrian government. Reporter Tariq Haddad was forbidden by his superiors to write about the many leaks coming out exposing malfeasance in the Duma investigation by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, on the basis that NED-funded Bellingcat had disputed the leaks and that other respectable outlets had not reported on them. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has published numerous articles documenting what Adam Johnson calls the North Korea Law of Journalism, which holds that editorial standards are inversely proportional to a country's enemy status. In other words, the more disfavorably a foreign government is viewed by the U.S. empire, the lower the editorial standards for reporting claims about them. Because Russia and Iran are both viewed as enemies of Washington, Western news media often feel comfortable just publishing any old claim about them as fact, regardless of sourcing or evidence. We saw this highlighted during the insanity of Russiagate, where mainstream news outlet after mainstream news outlet was caught publishing unevidenced conspiratorial hogwash that it was often, though not even always, forced to retract. This was possible because when it comes to implicating Russia, the evidentiary standards for reporting on something are much lower than they would be for implicating a government that is held in favor by the U.S. government. And this is the case because the Western mainstream media are the propaganda services of the U.S. centralized empire. They do not exist to tell people the truth. They exist to manipulate the public into hating the official enemies of the empire, and into consenting to foreign policy agendas that they would not otherwise consent to. Imperial propagandists lower their editorial standards when reporting on official enemies, not because they are bad at their job, but because they are very good at their job. It's just that their job isn't what we've been told.
And as we go out, here's another from the Urinetown musical called Don't Be the Bunny. This is a corporate head of industry who kind of runs the toilet business in Urinetown, where everybody has to pee, has to pay to pee, telling his wealthy daughter, who's kind of fighting for social justice, that she's taking the wrong tack. Don't be the bunny.
A little bunny in the meadow is nibbling grass without a care. He's so delightful as he hops for you. You say, hi, bunny, and he stops for you. You pull your trigger, and he trots for you. Goodbye, bunny boo. Hello, rabbit stew. Get me, boys.
You tell him, boss.
Don't be the bunny. Don't be the stew. Don't be the dinner. You have better things to do. It ain't no joke. That's why it's funny. So take your cue. Don't be the bunny. Don't be the bunny.
But Daddy, we're talking about people, not animals.
People are animals, Hope, dear.
Animals with huge incisors and big floppy feet?
Look closely, you'll see them. I do. I see them everywhere. A little bunny at a toll booth. He needs a measly 50 cents. Our little bunny didn't plan ahead. Hasn't got the bread. He begs for mercy but gets jail instead. Hasn't feathers in the air as the bunny gets the chair. See the moral, people.
Fear the same, boss.
Don't be the bunny. Don't be the dope. Don't be the loser. You're much better than that, Hope. You're born the power. You're in the money. Advice to you.
Don't be the bunny.
A bunny.
A little bunny at a toll booth.
You heard me.
But Daddy, bunnies don't drive cars.
Don't they?
No. Actually, I don't think they do.
Live long enough, Hope, dear. You see many things.
Even a daughter doubting her father?
A little bunny in a shoebox. He thinks he's found a brand new home. So snug and cozy on your closet floor. And then you open up your closet door. Now what's that bunny in my closet for? With a mallet and some clippers, you find out new bunny slippers. Grasp the message, staff.
Right behind your boss.
Don't be the bunny. Don't be the shoe.
You don't get stepped out.
The one who steps is you.
You're stepping up to where it's sunny.
Bring your dead or alive, Lord, bring your dead or Thank you.